evening, everyone. Just about time to get started. We're going to be looking at the book of Micah tonight. We spent a few weeks looking at the great prophet Amos and Hosea as they gave their message primarily to the northern kingdoms, the kingdom of Israel. And sort of the next one in line in the minor prophets is Micah. Primarily one who is aimed at the south, but whose message pointed northward as well. As we start into his book, one of the things that I want to do is an introduction. A lot of times when I'm researching, when I'm thinking, when I'm reading through it, it depends on the mood or whatever, but there are times when it just kind of hits you and you wonder, how did Micah introduce himself? How did he start? What would he have said to the people around him? How would he have gotten started on his lectures? We have the recording of the important parts that he gave. But can you imagine the first time he would have stepped out into a crowd and begun to speak to the people? And so we'll kind of think about it from that perspective a little bit. One of the things we like to do is take a look at the timeline, take a look at the area, take a look at the prophet, put it in its historical perspective. And we'll do that this morning, or this evening, I guess. In just a minute. Before we start, I'm going to ask Mark, if he would, to lead us in a word of prayer, please. Thank you all for coming. We have a good group assembled. My name is Micah. I was raised in a small rural community of Morasheth Gath. It's a beautiful area, mostly agricultural. We have beautiful fields, olive groves, flower-covered hills in the spring. But Morasheth is on the border of Judea, or Judah, and Philistia. We're about a two-day journey from Jerusalem. That's far enough away to be spared a lot of the politics, but close enough that we keep the news and understand what's going on. But being on the border of Philistia has its own challenges, and we have not been immune from the conflicts that have been through this community. Everyone still reminisces about the good old days. It's been about 200 years since King Solomon and that terrible civil war that split the nation. And it seems like the healing of that split will never come about. These days, it even seems that most of Judah and even the line of David give only lip service to truly worshiping the God of our fathers. Those of us who try to hold to his law are becoming rare. I was born during the reign of King Jotham. He ascended to the throne after his father Uzziah, and if you'll remember, he was struck with leprosy, a just punishment from God for his sin of pride and unfaithfulness. I remember as a child, my parents talked about their hope for reform when his son Jotham, who was only 25 years old when he took the throne, he managed to even defeat the Ammonites, but his religious reforms didn't really take hold all too soon. His morally corrupt son, Ahaz, ascended to the throne. Many of you my age grew up during that period. My parents still talked about their hope for that reform, but it was all dashed at that time. Our northern borders in Israel were not doing well. It seems that every year brought news of another uprising, assassination, unrest. No one's borders were secure. And the armies of Assyria were conquering everything in their path as they marched inevitably towards the south. When Judah did not join with Israel and Aram against the king of Israel, that Pekah joined with the dogs from Aram and invaded our land. It was during my coming of age, and I remember the devastation and destruction, and over 120,000 of our valiant men were killed in those battles. Our northern brothers would have made slaves of us, but thanks be to God, there was still a prophet of God in the north at that time, Oded by name, who convinced them of the seriousness of this transgression. The troubles just kept increasing. The Edomites and the Philistines, who you all know well, rebelled so that every border of Judah was under attack. There were stories of the great prophet Isaiah as he tried to guide and persuade Ahaz to put his trust in God. Ahaz would have nothing to do with it. He was even more unfaithful to the Lord, turning to Assyria for help. Can you imagine? And Tiglath-Pileser III was only too glad to help him, marching through Aram and Israel, destroying everything in his path. He killed King Pekah, put another puppet king, Hoshea, in his place, who is king now. And any wonder? Any surprise? His army did not stop at the border, but came on down and invaded our fair land. And Ahaz was put down to stripping away all of the gold, the bronze, and everything from his palace, as well as the very temple of God, in order to pay off the Assyrians. You'd think he would have learned his lesson, but he didn't. And became more unfaithful and sacrificed to the gods of Damascus. Thankfully, he's gone. It's only been a few years since his son Hezekiah took to the throne. Word from Jerusalem is that he is trying to turn the nation back to the Lord. He's aided in no small part by guidance from Isaiah. But will the people follow? Out here in the country, it seems like the high places still attract great throngs. The local leaders, both civil and spiritual, are still corrupt. The wealthy take advantage of the poor, and unjust scales are common in business. That's why the Lord has called me. Look over in Micah, the 3rd chapter, verse 8. Here was his statement to the people when he started his ministry to them. He said, "I am full of power with the Spirit of the Lord, with justice and courage to make known to Jacob his rebellious act, even to Israel his sin." I kind of think his first meeting would have gone something like that. He would have had to give an introduction to himself, who he was, why he was there, to call to mind the sins that surround him, but also call the people to acknowledge that they were part of the problem, and that if they didn't turn and put their hearts behind this new king Hezekiah, they were going to be in trouble as well. In Micah, the 1st chapter, verse 1, it says that he prophesied during the reigns of the kings of Jotham and Ahaz and Hezekiah. It doesn't even mention the king of the north. He probably was born during the very last years of in Pekah's reign, or last years of Jotham. Grew up during the time that Ahaz was really rebelling against God. And I put some verses down for the political situation there. If you want to go read about what I was just kind of paraphrasing, take a look at 2 Kings, the 15th through the 20th chapter, and 2 Chronicles, the 27th through the 32nd chapter. And you'll see there the history that went through those people and what they were going through with their kings. But a lot of times we don't think about what happened to the common people. We read Isaiah and that great prophet, and we realize that he had access to those kings. He went and talked to Ahaz. He was one of the ones who got there and said, "Ahaz, the God has granted you a boon." And Ahaz turned away from it. Micah, he's a counterpart. He's probably younger. He's out in the country. He's out with the rural population. Out there where probably we're a bit more conservative. But even there, they're beginning to turn away from God. They're not paying attention to the reforms that are trying to take hold, as Hezekiah is doing his best. And we read about Hezekiah. We'll catch little pieces of him as we go through the book of Micah. Not that he's mentioned specifically, but as we think about what was going on at that same time. And Micah, as he's trying to get his message out, we'll see that relationship for this call that although Hezekiah was one of the better kings of Judah, he was working against some really heavy odds as the people just were having a hard time turning back to their God. I want to look at a few verses before we start into the actual text and show what the moral situation was like that Micah was facing. Let's read a few verses. We're just going to scatter through here. Somebody turn over to Micah, the second chapter, verses 1 and 2. Can I get somebody to read Micah, the second chapter, verses 1 and 2? Okay. Who's he talking to there? Who's he talking about? Okay, they're evildoers. But who are they? They're his next door neighbors. They're the people who live in the next town over. And what do they have on their mind? What do they think about? We read the language there, but it's like, what are they thinking about when they get out of bed in the morning? Taking what's not theirs. How can I take advantage of somebody who can't protect themselves to enrich myself? That's their thoughts. We think about what should we be doing when we get out of bed in the morning, but maybe thinking about our God or thinking about our praise or our life or what we're going to do. And these people, they get up and they're going, who can I take advantage of today? Somebody read verses 8 and 9, second chapter, verses 8 and 9. Okay, who's he talking about? Is this some far-off group that we just hear about in the newspaper once in a while? Once again, these are the people that are around him, are they not? What are they doing? We just talked about the fact that there were a lot of wars going on. A lot of Israel and Judah didn't really have standing armies. They had these conscripts. They would go through and collect people from the towns and everything, and they'd go to make up an army. They'd go fight and win or lose. Then, well, whoever survived came back home. You can imagine going out, you're fighting for your country, fighting for your king. You're walking back home. And what does it say happens? Somebody robs them on their way home. And I kind of get the impression from the context here that while they weren't at home, who's taking advantage of the women who are having to stay behind? That's the moral climate that Micah is calling out. Take a look at the third chapter. Somebody read verses 1 through 3. Chapter 3, verses 1 through 3. Larry? Okay, who's he talking to there? Okay, now we got the leaders. He'd been talking about just the people and the wealthy, and now who's he saying is condemned for what they're doing? But the leaders, what are they doing? What's the description there? Kind of graphic, isn't it? Absolutely. That's the imagery that he's using. Now, I don't think it's literal that he's meaning there, but figuratively, what's that mean? Just chewing them up, spitting them out, right? Whatever they can rip off of somebody, regardless of whether it hurts them or not, they're taking it. Is that what the leaders were supposed to be doing? Is it any wonder that the population was having a problem when that was the state of the leaders? How about verse 5? Somebody skip down and read verse 5.
Thus says the Lord concerning the prophets who make my people stray, who chant peace while they chew with their teeth, but who prepare war against them, who puts nothing into their mouths.
Okay. It's an interesting way of phrasing it there. I want you to think about it for a minute. Who's the subject? Who's he talking about now? We've got the rulers before. Now who is it? It's the prophets. Now, they got good things to say when what? When they're fed. Okay, who do you think's feeding them? People who want good things said, right? When are they saying the bad things? Yeah, when they don't feed them. What's that called? I'll only tell you what you want to know when you give me something. They were taking bribes, weren't they? I was like, they just wanted bribes. Were they interested in saying what God wanted them to say? They're supposed to be prophets. That's the title that they're holding. No. They were as corrupt as the rest of them. So he's hit the people. He's hit the judges. He's hit the leaders. He's hit the prophets. Who else now? Let's just take over in the 6th chapter, verses 10 to 12. David? Okay, who's he talking about there? Yeah, I think this is the merchant class. Okay, these are the people who are the merchants. They're the buyers and the sellers. How can you tell? What are their instruments? Yeah. Scales? Weights? Yeah. I wrote an article for an old Kimmy magazine years ago on the establishments of weights and measures and the kinds of things that we've been through in the world trying to standardize on stuff, right? We don't think anything about it. You go to the grocery store and you look at something and it says it's, you know, $4.50 a pound. That's not in the meat department, I guarantee you. And you say, well, I want a pound of it. What do? They grab some stuff out, you know, vegetable men, and they'll throw it up on the scales. The scale reads a pound. They put it in a sack. You pay them for it, right? Why do we trust that?
Because the king said it was true.
Yeah, there you go. We actually have a king who put together the National Institute of Standards and Technology who have decided exactly what a pound is, and there are inspectors that go around and make sure that these scales are within a certain percentage of reading correctly. You ever been to the gas station when you've got a little sticker on the pump, right? And it says, this has been inspected. There's been a guy out. I used to work at a gas station when I was in high school. That was kind of fun because a guy would show up occasionally. He's got this 5-gallon, like, milk can. And he goes out there, and you know, we have to turn the pump on for him. And he sets this thing up till it gets to the line. He looks at that. He looks at the can. It says 5 gallons. Good to go. You get your sticker. What were these people doing? I got 2 sets of weights, right? If I'm buying, I got a weight that's been shaved off a little bit, right? And to get a pound, you got to give me more than what you're thinking about there. Or actually, it's the other way around. But if I'm selling you something by the pound, what am I doing? Because scales, remember? They got the weight on one side and you put your stuff on the other side. They got a light one. You're cheating. That's the climate that they're in. Everybody's cheating. How about chapter 7, verses 2 and 3. Chapter 7, verses 2 and 3. Okay, love the imagery there as well. They can do evil equally well with what? Both hands, right? My eldest son, Aaron, considered that a truly balanced meal was a cookie in each hand. That was a balanced meal, right? What do these things people think a balanced day is? Oh, that's when I can do evil with either hand, right? So what's the climate that Micah is stepping into? If he's got this material scattered all through his book, what kind of people is he dealing with? But now think about it for a second. If you were to have asked them, if you were to set them down, a little village, and group all together, and said, are you guys just evil people? What would they have said? What, us? Yeah. No, I mean, it's kind of the way things are. But we're not so bad. In fact, probably pointing up north and going, we're not nearly as bad as those guys, right? They're a lot worse. At least we're not like them. That's kind of Micah's perspective as he starts getting into this. Because he's going to talk about the people up north first. Then when he comes down and starts accusing Judah, They're guilty of the same things. Let's go over to chapter 1 then. It says, the word of the Lord which came to Micah of Moresheth in the days of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, the kings of Judah, which he saw concerning Samaria and Jerusalem. Hear, O peoples, all of you, listen, O earth, and all it contains, and let the Lord God be a witness against you, the Lord from his holy temple. For behold, the Lord is coming forth from his place. He will come down and tread on the high places of the earth. The mountains will melt under him, and the valleys will be split like wax before the fire, like water poured down a steep place. All this is for the rebellion of Jacob and for the sins of the house of Israel. What is the rebellion of Jacob? Is it not Samaria? What is the high place of Judah? Is it not Jerusalem? For I will make Samaria a heap of ruins in the open country, planting places for a vineyard. I will pour her stones down into the valley and will lay bare her foundations. All of her idols will be smashed, and all of her earnings will be burned with fire, and all of her images I will make desolate. For she collected them from a harlot's earnings, and to the earnings of a harlot they will return. That's his opening phrase. That's his opening volley. I think he would have gotten their attention. I think as they're standing there listening to him, and he's using words like this. He says, what is? What is the rebellion of Jacob? What was the answer? Samaria. What's Samaria? What city is it? Capital city of Israel, right? So, does he mean that's the only place that's bad? It's just Samaria? Representative of the whole nation, right? Because that's where the leadership was. That's where it was that led them astray. It was representative of the nation. How well is it going to fare in the coming judgment of God? You like the imagery there, right? What does he say he's going to do to all the stones? Torn up, tumble down. Foundations. Now, foundations were a pretty big thing then, right? You get a good, solid foundation, the building stays. What's going to happen to these foundations? Yeah, lay bare. Lay bare. Nothing left on top of them. And insult to injury? You know, they probably took some good prime land and built this city on it. Now what's it going to do? They're going to plow it all up, plant vineyards on there instead. Kind of the earth will heal itself as it just obliterates, is the idea. The existence that Samaria was there. Why? Does he say yet? Not quite. But he's calling them out for their sins. And he's saying that they've got a judgment that's coming. Now, when he calls this witness, let the Lord God be a witness against you. How is it that God was a witness against them? Would the people have been surprised, perhaps, at Micah's invective start here? This coming judgment? Perhaps. Why shouldn't they have been surprised? When we looked at the book of Hosea, who was somewhat a contemporary, if we go back and look at the timeline there, you can see that Hosea was finishing up when Micah was starting. And Hosea called them out in the north. And he had a message about their harlotry, right? And one of the messages that we talked about in Hosea that was part of the, just sort of the fabric of that book, was this problem of breaking the covenant. That God had given and made a covenant with them. He had told them what he expected. But over time, things had been forgotten. My introduction, I happened to mention 200 years since Solomon. This time period, there are about 200 years past when Solomon was. How far are we past the Civil War? When was the Civil War? Yeah, just kind of think of mid-1800s, right? 1850, 1950, 2050. We're not quite 200 years from the Civil War. So think about it in that time frame. Do we still talk about it? Is it still talked about in our schools and We still have problems even in the country today with people with a lot of discussion about various monuments and things hanging around. You know, what should we do with these monuments to these people that are now politically incorrect? My answer is to hang a medal around them that says second place, but that's... But can you imagine these people in discussion? You think there were still things that would have reminded them of that time period? We talk about the good old days, right? Back in our parents or great-grandparents or something like that, good old days. Things were better back then. You think they weren't talking about the good old days of Solomon? What happened? How did we get there where we are today? Boy, that's a question people still ask, isn't it? From a moral and political standpoint, how did we get here? What was the answer for them? How did they get there? They forgot God. They forgot God. That's kind of the answer for just about any time when you look at a country that's going downhill and they start asking themselves, how did we get here? That's always a pretty good answer. They forgot God. So he brings this indictment against them. But you can get the sense that Micah is kind of this combination of Amos and Hosea. Amos was stern. Anybody remember what the sort of one of the guiding phrases in Amos was? What's the most probably famous line from the book of Amos? Let justice. Nobody remembers. You got to remember this one. Let justice roll down like water. And he wasn't talking about a little trickle. He was talking about a cleansing flood that was going to wash the iniquity away. Let justice roll down like water. That was Amos's attitude. Let's just clean this place up. Hosea. Now there was a man who, you can see this, what am I going to do with you? Now, this is not what I want. This is not, you're asking for punishment and I don't want to give it. Well, Micah's going to be kind of in between. Micah's going to call for the justice and the judgment. But look at how he answers his opening salvo of the coming destruction. Because of this, I must lament and wail. I must go barefoot and naked. I must make a lament like the jackals and a mourning like the ostriches. For her wound is incurable, for it has come to Judah. It has reached the gate of my people, even to Jerusalem. Was he just standing with the sword in his hand and wanting to just cut them all off? He said, no, it's going to happen. But I hope you see in his voice that he understands what's coming is necessary. But it is not going to be good. And he feels for the people. But did you notice there where he's talking about, I see where this came from. He says, it's even coming to my people. Who were his people? The ones there in Judah, right? The ones that he was closest to. And he's saying, those sins that we just denounced in Samaria, they've come down here. People are doing the same things. And that's why he's lamenting. That's why he's wailing. The next series of things are kind of interesting. Most of the commentators, if you read them, agree that all of these towns are kind of a play on words. And the whole idea is a poetic mourning and a progression. Some people used to try to line it up with maybe the march of the Assyrian kings as they came through and that sort of thing. But I don't think that's it because it doesn't really line up that way. These are all villages. Some we know where they are. Some we don't. I was going to mark them all on the map, and I kind of gave up because I couldn't find half of them. But each of the names has something interesting. So I'm going to tell you about the names first, if you start looking at them, and then we'll read the passage. He's going to use the name for Gath, which is kind of a literal meaning for tell town. And part of what he's going to say is, don't tell it in Gath. And he's going to use a derivative of Akko, which means weep town, when he's saying not to weep. And in Beth Le'Afrah, there's a relationship with dust in the name of that town. And in Shafir, it was a fair town. He's going to talk about the fact that their fairness is taken away. And by fair, I don't mean just. I mean the fact that they were pretty. Marchtown in Zanaan. Neighbor town in Beth Ezel. They're going to take away their support. This bitter town. Lachish is, in Hebrew, sounds very close in the name of the word to the name that's used for chariot. And so he's going to make this play between Lachish and Horsetown. And in fact, Lachish was one of the strongholds in the area. And we know that under the Assyrians, it was devastated as well. And then there's a little town called Achzib, which means false spring. And it's going to wind up becoming a disappointing brook. And then he ends up, hit the wrong button there. He ends up with this town called Maresha, which has to do with the heir. But the heir is not going to be from Judah. The heir is going to be this conqueror that's going to come in, which in the end is going to wind up being Sargon. So let's take a look at verses 8 through 16. Because of this, I must lament and wail. I must go barefoot and naked. I must lament like the jackals and a mourning like the ostriches, for her wound is incurable. It has come to Judah. It has reached the gate of my people, even to Jerusalem. Tell it not in Gath. Weep not at all. At Beth Le'Afra, roll yourself in the dust. Go on your way, inhabitant of Shafir, in shameful nakedness. The inhabitant of Zanaan does not escape. The lamentation of Beth Ezel, he will take from you its support. For the inhabitant of Moroth becomes weak, waiting for good, because a calamity has come down from the Lord to the gate of Jerusalem. Harness the chariot to the team of horses, O inhabitants of Lachish. She was the beginning of sin to the daughter of Zion, because in you were found the rebellious acts of Israel. Therefore you will give parting gifts on behalf of Moresheth-Gath. The houses of Achzib will become a deception to the kings of Israel. Moreover, I will bring on you the one who takes possession, O inhabitants of Maresha. The glory of Israel will enter Adullam. Make yourself bald, cut off your hair, because of the children of your delight. Extend your baldness like the eagle, for they will go from you into exile. It's kind of like Mark was talking about this morning. Sometimes when you're reading through a passages, it's difficult because of the translation to catch some of the little things there. But hopefully as you start looking at this and you're thinking about these play on words, he's also using village names and town names that are very familiar to them. Now, did you notice anything kind of in common in all of these? Each of the places that he named? What's the common thread that kind of runs through here?
Devastation.
There's devastation. Kind of the lament, the sadness. Do you see the sadness in this passage? Is this something that Micah is like, cheering on and that he thinks he wants to happen? But does he believe it will happen? And that's why he's standing up and giving this message.
Very similar
time to Jesus looking at Jerusalem. Absolutely. In Matthew 24, when Jesus was looking over Jerusalem, when the apostles were, at the time, pointing out all of these buildings and saying, what a lovely city we have. And what was Jesus' response? Oh, Jerusalem, I would have gathered you as what? A hen gathers her chicks. But you would not. And that's the same kind of thing that Micah has, is that the people were bringing this on themselves, and they didn't even realize it. And, you know, it's kind of hard for us to think about it that way because we're in the mode of thinking that people would learn lessons. But one of the things that I mentioned in the introduction was Ahaz, and if you read about him in 2 Chronicles, it talks about the fact that he rebelled against God, and he just kept getting smashed. And so every time things would go really bad, he'd go change gods, but never back to Jehovah. It was like, we'll try the Assyrian gods. Well, that didn't work. Let's try the Syria. There's Assyria and Syria. It's kind of hard to get those two straight sometimes. We'll just pick all these other gods until we find one that helps, right? Abandoning totally the gods of his fathers. Well, Micah is looking at a country that's been going in that direction that is only recently trying to pull out. Chapter 2, if we go back to our outline, really talks about the oppressors. We read parts of this, but I want to put it in context here. As we begin to look at his indictment of who the problems are. Woe to those who scheme iniquity, who work out evil on their beds. When morning comes, they do it, for it is in the power of their hands. They covet fields and seize them, and houses and take them away. They rob a man and his house, a man and his inheritance. Therefore, thus says the Lord, behold, I am planning against this family a calamity from which you cannot remove your necks. And you will not walk haughtily, for it will be an evil time. On that day they will take up against you a taunt and utter a bitter lamentation and say, we are completely destroyed. He exchanges the portion of my people, how he removes it from me. To the apostate he apportions our fields. Therefore you will have no one stretching a measuring line for you by lot in the assembly of the Lord. That last piece is kind of an interesting line. You will have no one stretching a measuring line. What do you mean by that, you think? In the assembly of the Lord. Measuring line, what is it? They would use that when they were making buildings, right? And that's how you could tell when the wall lines were straight. It was something that was used as a standard. You could see whether or not you were meeting where you ought to be. And in the assembly of the Lord, is God going to be looking at people and judging and seeing if they meet his standard? We say on these people, you're so far below that, you're not even going to make it to that point. You're not going to have anyone trying to measure you because there's just no sense in it. You're too far gone. And why were they too far gone? Well, they were just concentrating on everything else besides what God wanted from them. So he looks at it. He says, do not speak out. So they speak out. But if they do not speak out concerning these things, reproaches will not be turned back. Is it being said, O house of Jacob, is the spirit of the Lord impatient? Are these his doings? Do not my words do good to the one walking uprightly? Recently my people have arisen as an enemy. You strip the robe off the garment from the unsuspecting passers-by, from those returning from war. The women of my people you evict, each one from her pleasant house, from her children you take my splendor forever. Arise and go, for this is no place of rest, because of the uncleanness that brings on destruction, a painful destruction. If a man walking after wind and falsehood had told lies and said, I will speak out to you concerning wine and liquor, he would be spokesman to this people. Who are they really wanting to hear from? What's this last guy saying? Eat, drink, and be merry. So what if tomorrow we may die, right? We can have a good time today. That's what they were looking at just today. What could they do today? No view to the future. No view to what God wanted them to have. So when you look at that and he says, what are they telling Micah? See, I think that's what he's really kind of starting at verse 6 there. What's their instructions to Micah as he begins this presentation to them of their fate and where they are? Right? Don't speak out. Don't say anything. Now, they were being kind of, man, we just don't want to hear this, right? And it's interesting. Isn't that the way that people react a lot of times? If they're kind of going down a path, and maybe internally they know it's not the best, but it's the way they're going. How well do people normally take instruction when you want to go, folks, you might want to rethink this? It's a normal action. Yeah. Don't judge me, right? Right? If you want to speak out to say that you take a stand on something, what's the likely consequence in today's environment? This is hate speech, right? That's politically incorrect. One of the things that scares me when I read the prophets is just how many parallels there are to what goes on around us now. Now, yeah, there's a lot of differences. But when push comes to shove and you look at how people react to those who would try to say what's good, when it gets to a point where people don't want to hear it, they tell you they don't want to hear it, and they're willing to call evil good and good evil, as Isaiah said, then we got a situation that's pretty close to what was coming up with the minor prophets, do we not? Now, we don't know what God has in store for this nation or any other that's in those conditions. That's his domain, not ours. But, folks, we need to keep in mind as we're studying these folks like the minor prophets that God is still in charge of the nations. How do we know that? I don't know that God's still in charge of things. I mean, that was just Old Testament stuff, right? Anybody think of a good way of saying that God's still in charge? Okay, still allowing us to live. Yeah, the evidence is around us in a lot of ways. My favorite, though, is go to the book of Revelation. When John was saying who the message was really from, and he said it was from Jesus Christ, what was one of the titles that he gave him? The ruler of the kings of the earth. Now, when did he abrogate that position? Hasn't. Even John was wanting to remind us that it's still in God's hands. And that's what Micah is trying to remind the people here, is that this judgment is still in God's hands. And his call, as we get through the book, is going to be for them, after pointing out these bad things, the call for their repentance. You see, that's where people will start down the right path, or they won't. And during the time of Hezekiah, Hezekiah was really trying. He actually had good political support. But as we know, it didn't take off like it should have. I will surely assemble all of you, Jacob. I will surely gather the remnant of Israel. I will put them together like sheep in the fold, like a flock in the midst of its pasture. They will be noisy with men. The breaker goes up before them. They break out, pass through the gate, and go out by it. So their king goes out before them, and the Lord at their head. So there's going to be a small group of survivors. I think that's what he's talking about here. I'm going to gather together this remnant, this like a bunch of sheep that are just a small group of what the whole flock was. And they'll break out of this, and the Lord will be at their head. But from the standpoint of the whole nation, if you look at all of the God's people that could have been there, this is going to be a small group that's going to survive. And that's the future they have to look forward to. And that means we're out of time. First chapter, couple of chapters. Come back next week. We'll be looking at chapter 3, probably through 5. We'll see what we get. Thank you.